You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Each Friday at this time, we review the week in state politics with perspectives from the left and right. Rob Schofield works with the Liberal North Carolina Justice Center, and Becky Gray is with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Great to be with you.
This week, the House voted overwhelmingly to approve a Raise the Age bill. This proposal would send teenagers into the juvenile justice system rather than automatically trying them as adults. North Carolina is the only state left in the country that has yet to do this. Rob, why is this significant?
Well, you just stated that we're the last state in the country to do it. I think the thing that really strikes me about it is that, you know, it sort of reminds me of when we passed the bill to compensate victims of forced sterilization and eugenics. It's decades too late. It's probably still going to be inadequate. There are indications that we may only do it for some limited offenses, that felonies or higher grade felonies will still be automatically treated as adults, that we may not have enough funding for the facilities and the services that we need for these young, you know, offenders. So, you know, it's good. It's certainly a step in the right direction. I think it's a thing, one of those rare instances where Becky and I agree on a proposal. But from my perspective, it's too late and doesn't go far enough.
Interesting that Rob mentioned the eugenics effort, and we were involved in that as well. And I've had the same feeling as we were working through this. This is one of those that it's definitely time to do this, and it is also the right thing to do. And, you know, one of the things that struck me in this, too, is there's lots of differences in the way that juveniles are treated going through the juvenile justice system and going through the adult system. But one of the most compelling ones to me is that there's a lot of family counseling. Their parents are involved. There's real involvement from lots of different people with this. They also receive education, whatever they need, working on GEDs or those kind of things. And you're talking about 16 and 17-year-olds. And, of course, the bill that was passed in the House applies to those nonviolent felonies and misdemeanors. Only less than 4% of those 16 and 17-year-olds commit those violent crimes. Those would be left out of. That's a different category entirely. But these are kids that many believe, and studies have shown us, and as Rob mentioned, we're the only state left that hasn't done it. So we can look at other states and how this has worked. And it has worked very well.
And so, the truth of the matter, of course, I'd also add is that, you know, there's no magic number. I mean, the truth of the matter is a lot of 19 and 20 and 21-year-olds whose brains haven't developed either. So it's a, you know, it's certainly a step in the right direction. I also don't think we should get carried away with describing the services that these young people are going to receive. I mean, in many instances, they'll certainly be better than being in an adult jail, but it's not like it's a day at the park, and it's not like all of our services are the best in the world and well-funded. So it's, again, an incremental step that's necessary, but I still think we have a long way to go.
Becky, this is through the House.
Right.
The appetite on the Senate side has been, I would say, more limited. What happens from here?
Yeah, well, actually, the Senate has come out with this. It was included in their budget. Now, a little bit different in that they didn't have any funding into it. So it was more just, we like this idea and we want to include it. And then the other big difference is the Senate plan only included misdemeanors rather than taking that other, I think, 17% of the crimes that are committed, of those low-level felonies. So there's some room to work this out, for sure. Sure. And I think that we'll see that, if not through a separate bill, I think that we may see this rolled into the final budget. Because, as Rob mentioned, it does require some funding to make this happen. That's an important part of it.
Yes. And to that point, Rob, you mentioned it's too late. We can't turn back the hands of time. But in terms of not going far enough, what would you like to have seen this policy have done additionally?
Well, I really think that it should include all crimes that folks are accused of. If there's a need in an egregious case to transfer someone back to the adult system, and there's a compelling showing made by a prosecutor that, you know, someone is a predator or it's some horrific crime and the judge consents, then, you know, maybe that's a way to go. I think that the presumption should be for all offenses when you're 16 or 17 years old that you shouldn't be tried as an adult because you're not an adult.
But when you say all, murder, rape,
sure.
Assault with a deadly weapon?
Sure. All those offenses. Now, again, that's how it's done in many states, and then you have this provision for transferring it to the adult system. But, I mean, who are we kidding? There are 15-year-olds that commit, you know, heinous offenses, too, and we already have provisions for trying them as adults in some instances. So, again, I think we could do more to ratchet up the presumption that we're going to treat children as children. I also think that there's clearly more that we could do in terms of funding our juvenile justice system. Even as it exists now, it's inadequate, it's underfunded, the people are overworked who work in the system, just like most of state government. So there's a lot more we could do to make it an effective, efficient, humane system that actually, you know, that makes a difference in people's lives and protects the public.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal to North Carolina's invalidated voter ID law. This is the latest legal defeat for lawmakers in Raleigh. However, this issue of voter ID and voting access and provisions is unlikely to go away anytime soon. Becky?
I would absolutely agree with that. Of course, we're seeing this across the country. There are other states that are grappling with this as well. Different courts are weighing in different parts of this. I think that we can absolutely see another voter ID bill proposed before we get out of session. But don't forget, too, that this particular law also included some things of the number of early voting days and the same-day registration. So it wasn't just the voter ID that was part of this law.
Right. Five big provisions: reduction of early voting 17 to 10 days, eliminating out-of-precinct balloting, and same-day registration, also doing away with pre-registration. We're going to see another iteration of this, I expect, Rob. What do you expect to see?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to there's a reason that the advocates describe it as a voter suppression bill or the monster voting bill, because it is a lot more than voter ID, but it all goes to that end. That's what this is about. We've had another election in which we've seen this myth of voter fraud is just that, a myth that is incredibly rare. This is an unnecessary bill. It's part of a national strategy by conservatives that they have realized is effective in suppressing voters who they think will vote for the other side. So I'm sure they're not going to give up, and they think that Chief Justice Roberts, is sending them a little message to give it another shot, that they couldn't figure out a way to go after this law, which the Fourth Circuit said targeted African Americans with surgical precision. They didn't want to make this the case. So I have no doubt the conservatives will try it again.
Almost surgical precision.
Yeah.
Judge Roberts is an incrementalist, and I'll attribute that to some of the attorneys I've talked to over the last week. And there are other pending challenges in Wisconsin and in Texas. And the prevailing thought from legal minds, I don't even purport to have a legal mind, people who know this stuff well think that it will be a smaller in scope election law that makes it back up through the Fourth Circuit and to the U.S. Supreme Court from North Carolina, if one is to make it.
Well, and don't forget, too, 32 states have some kind of voter ID. So North Carolina is not alone in this, certainly. And, you know, as you mentioned, it's going through other states, going through other courts. And I do think that this General Assembly will pass some reiteration of that, whether it's just a strict voter ID or if it has other provisions in it. I don't know at this point. This has been relatively new. Mm-hmm. Just happened this week. So, but they've got plenty of time to get this through the General Assembly. And I expect that we will see that.
There was a poll recently out of Elon University. It's not in front of me, but if I'm recalling it correctly, it's somewhere between 75% and 80% of respondents are in support of voter ID. Where are you both on having to show photo ID in order to vote?
It's interesting. You know, I'm old enough to remember a time when conservatives were the folks who led the charge against the idea of mandatory government ID. I remember when President Carter proposed a national identification card, and it was conservatives who shot it down because of the idea of big government. You know, I think it's been proven that what voter ID requirements do is suppress the vote. They target people who don't have ID, which tend to be poor people, tend to be people of color. And there's been no showing of any credible evidence that I've seen that it has any real impact on fraud, because there is so little fraud. We already have penalties against fraud in elections. So I think it's a bad idea. And I think actually once voters understand that and the question is posed in a way rather than just very simplistically, as some pollsters unfortunately have a tendency to do, the numbers actually get a lot closer.
What we saw was the General Assembly respond to those concerns about poor people, other people not being able to get a voter ID, and put some provisions in the bill that would, you can get one for free. They made it easier to get the ID. I think the reason why you're seeing those numbers in the poll is that most people think that it is reasonable to present an ID. There's so many things that we do to get on an airplane, to get a prescription drug, to do all, get in government buildings. You know, when you go to the governor's mansion, mm-hmm. you have to present a photo ID before you can get in there. And so I think it's just become a very expected thing. And what we've seen is it increases the integrity of elections. When people feel like their vote counts, they're actually, the voter participation goes up when those kind of things are in place to ensure the integrity of the elections. I think we'll see it in North Carolina. Again, I think we'll see a bill this session, and I think that we will see it go into place.
Meanwhile, a report from the state auditor this week found that North Carolina's largest managed care organization misused funds and improperly authorized more than $1 million in salary. The audit says Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions, they provide for an estimated 85,000 people who have mental illness and developmental disabilities across the state, spent money on strategic planning that should have gone toward behavioral health services. How big of a deal is this?
Well, I think it's emblematic of the ongoing, you know, unsolved problem we have with mental health in our state. I for one, don't think it was the right move to go to the sort of quasi-privatization model that we've gone to, in which we have entities who have an incentive to sort of make money for themselves and pay their CEOs fabulous salaries, as Cardinal was doing. I think that's, you know, an unfortunate direction that we've gone in. So I hope this will continue to get the message through to people that this ought to be a public service. It ought to be something run by the state, I think. Everyone had to have a right to mental health services, and we ought not to be meeting it out in this way. That said, I hope that it doesn't lead to more cuts to mental health funding. We already have big, according to NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, there's something like $170 million cut in the Senate budget to mental health funding. So that's certainly not the answer to this problem either. I'm glad that Beth Wood's office, the auditor's office, did this. I think it's important, and we need to keep an eye on these people because there is just, it's an unavoidable phenomenon in life that when you're taking public funds into a private entity, there's an incentive to misuse them for your own benefits quite often.
Jeff, in answer to your question, I think it's a big enough deal that it really sends a message, and I think this is important. You know, one thing that I think is significant in this audit is there was no indication of fraud or malfeasance or anything like that. It was just, you know, how the money is allocated. Mm-hmm. I think that Cardinal Innovations and other recipients of taxpayer money need to be held accountable. Kudos to Beth Woods. I think she does a great job as our state auditor. I'm a big fan. And this is the kind of important work that she does to hold these organizations throughout state government accountable. I think it's important to do. And again, I think it's important to ask those questions. Now, in this audit, about 21 pages is of the audit. 22 pages are Cardinal Innovation Healthcare Solutions' response to that. So the fact that they're taking it seriously, they thank her for this audit, they welcome that. I mean, at least, you know, the report that they have welcomes the opportunity to look at things perhaps a little bit differently, to clean up things where it needs to be, to clarify some of the things. So I think this is a healthy thing. I think it's a good thing, and I think it's a big enough deal that we're going to see this, you know, throughout state government. As Rob mentions, you know, when private entities are getting money to perform these kind of services, I like the privatization, but there's responsibility that goes along with it.
I wasn't planning on asking you about the wild week in Washington, but I'm going to ask you about the wild week in Washington, just kind of off the cuff here. We hadn't chatted about this beforehand. This, I imagine, will probably only be for the web version of this week in review here of North Carolina politics. It seemed like one gigantic shoe after another kept dropping in the district. I don't even have a question prepared, so I guess I'll throw it out. Did you think it would escalate or devolve this quickly, this soon? And what's on the horizon as, sorry to make you feel old, a couple people that remember Richard Nixon and remember, I mean, a lot of parallels. Is that, and if you don't remember Nixon.
No, I vividly do. I think I was in middle school and watching the Watergate hearings on television in middle school. There are some similarities. I've seen some compelling, I think it was John Meacham who was in town recently at a News and Observer event, who made the argument that there is some big differences between Nixon, that Nixon was actually a sort of a tragic figure and someone who actually was a very bright man who had many, you know, had some good ideas, but unfortunately was captive to his own mental problems. I think the current inhabitant of the White House is a mentally ill person just right off the bat who doesn't get it, doesn't have any idea of what he's doing, is the most unqualified president we've ever had. And so I'm not surprised, I suppose, that this continues to devolve. I actually am not that optimistic, however, that there's going to be any kind of an impeachment. I think the fact that Mueller is now in there as the independent counsel is a positive sign. It'll be fascinating to see what he does. I mean, we all sit here and try to concoct scenarios of what happens next. Is it the 25th Amendment? Is it an actual impeachment proceeding? I think we're a long way away from that. I think that the Republicans who are in charge in Washington have shown themselves not very interested in going down this road, if at all possible. They'd like to avoid it. And so it's going to take a real amazing smoking gun, because there have been a lot of them so far, I would think, that don't seem to have risen to the level to get folks fired up who are running the show in Congress to take action. I think we're maybe a long way off from that.
It has been a wild week in Washington. I think that's probably an understatement. I agree with Rob. I think, you know, one of the best signs that I saw is this Mueller stepping forward. I think that's a really good sign. It seems like there's an adult, at least in the room now. You know, kind of interesting to observe, too. It has been a wild week. But, you know, just stop a minute and think. It's only been 5 months of the Trump presidency. 5 months. And you look over this roller coaster that has taken place. You know, on the one hand, there is a lot of there's a lot going on. It's very open. Where this ends, I don't know. I keep waiting for Congress to step in.
Not to correct you, we've covered 5 months. It's actually only been 4 months.
Okay,
seems like
right. Yeah, there's the
right.
point.
Right.
I don't know what's going to happen. I hope that Vice President Pence is staying in good health. And we'll see what happens.
And I hope Senator Burr is, you know, I read that story with interest in the New York Times. I think it was Paul Shoemaker who said the night that Richard Burr was first elected to the Senate, he said, boy, I sure hope they don't put me on the Senate Intelligence Committee, you know. And boy, is that, now he's in charge of the whole mess. And it's clear that he's not relishing this, that he is not diving into it with all, you know, with all of his energy. I hope very much that he rises to.
He's not pulling an Irvin. Is that not yet?
But I feel that Senator Burr being there is a good sign. I think that I think he's a steady hand.
Well,
in this,
I think
we need more steady hands.
The country needs that for sure. I very much hope that is true, and I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch, part of the North Carolina Justice Center. Thank you both.
Thanks, you.
Jeff. You can hear an extended version of our conversation at our website, wunc.org.